check in with you and just kind of hear what you're hearing, and if you want to ask a question or steer us in a direction. And if you're on the live stream, we will be sitting down with you in about an hour. But if you want to ask a question now, just type it in, and Sarah will read it to us. But so over to you. What's landing? What's going on in there? Yeah, Leon.
Something specific. I've had lots of insights, and I'm trying to keep my attention on not the insight about blah blah blah, as you were saying, but just the insight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost more of a, when you talk about it, it's almost more of a geographical thing than anything else. Like you're trying to get to a place as opposed mm-hmm. to get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, I had the insight about money. Like money hasn't really been an issue for me. Like I was always happy to have a low amount of money. I used to look around and people were always talking about, oh, I don't have money, and even the CTI, everyone wanted to like get money, and I was like, money, like that's not what it is. But then the past 2 weeks I've just been kind of obsessively thinking about how little money I have. You know, sleeping on the floor of my brother's apartment, and I was like, wow, this sucks. I don't like it at all. And at the same time I've been feeling very, very lazy. Like I really don't want to do anything. And the combination of those two things for me is like a rough experience. Like I should be doing stuff, I should be working, but at the same time I just don't want to get off this seat, this couch right now.
Yeah.
And I've had experiences where I did nothing in the past and then something came out of it and it doesn't seem like it's working anymore in that same regard. But I just realized now, like long and short, it is maybe I don't. I need a little bit, right?
Oh,
but
maybe
I don't need like the yacht or the Aston Martin or even a place of my own or even a bedroom. You know, it's not that bad. It's kind of fun, I suppose, in a way to be in the position that I'm in. And that's so simple, but it never really occurred to me until just now. The reason I'm not manifesting or that my life isn't, you know, fanfares and trumpets is because that's not even really what I'm.
You know, I think in general, and when we think we should have something or shouldn't have something, the more we do that, the less it happens. Like the more you want to get married, the less you find men to marry or women to marry. The more you, so I think the kind of what you're, I think, stumbled into here is that it's just a matter of finding contentment in what is. And right now, your life is what it is. So as you find contentment, then your eyes change and you see opportunities and you see how to continually make your life nice and in whatever way works for you. I can imagine that perhaps your parents would want you to move out and have a place of your own, you know?
I do, but it's not my place.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? It's like it's like as you go through life, you connect with different people, and so their decisions are different. And so for right now, it's just great. But you want to stay in the right now because every time you shift on the inside, then you see how to make your life be more supportive of living in a beautiful feeling. You know, it's kind of like your feeling is always the indicator of your state of mind. So when you're kind of down or tired or all that, to me, what I do is I think, oh man, I've just been thinking too much again. I got to relax and chill out and then see what happens. So when you're in a good place and then you don't like have to think about it one way or the other.
Do you mind sharing what you told me about like when you met your husband? Because that's just an interesting contrast.
When I moved to Hawaii, I had sold my business in Minnesota and moved over, and I thought I'd just start another clinic, and I'd put it up and people would come. You know, if you build it, they will come. And so it wasn't happening, and so I had to, like, go to work for another company and a more traditional therapist. And then I met my husband, and my husband had just gone through a divorce. And so with the cost of living in Hawaii, it was difficult for him to have a good lodging, so he was staying here, there, and everywhere. And when I first asked him, you know, where do you live? And he said, well, I live here, in his van is what he was talking about. And I was like, really? This is interesting. And so we were both like really poor because all the money I had gone into the business and they didn't come. It's kind of a rule in Hawaii that you have to be there a year before people take you as credible. And it was interesting because as he got to know the principles more and we started living together out of necessity. And we both got into a nicer state of mind. We went from that to now we have a, 4,000 square foot house with a 180 degree view of the ocean and 10 acres of land in the Big Island. So that is like, that's really an unbelievable shift in consciousness, and that's what it created. Now, we would never have thought of that. At the time, we just were like fell in love, and I thought, oh, this man's got the nicest feeling of anybody I've ever met in my life, and that was the most important thing to me. It's because I knew that the rest of it would all change and fall into place as we went through life, and that's what happened. Like, we were living together, and then his wife had the kids, and she said, I can't take care of them anymore. You take them. So we moved in, and he was supposed to have gone home for a month and prepared them for my coming, which he didn't do. So when I moved in, they were shocked to find out that this girlfriend is now living with us. And so we had to move from that house to another house, and went through all kinds of things. But it was like within 6 months, he got a really, really good job with the union, and then progressively worked his way up in the union. And he's like, he was just able to make such a beautiful life for us but we don't care about money. Either one of us don't care about money. It's like, that's not important. And so the thing is not to be frivolous about money. But if money looks like the source of your well-being, you're screwed. That's why they say it's easier for a rich man to... it's either easier for a camel to...
The eye of a needle.
...than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Because when we think that money is where our happiness is, people get greedy and they get controlling and they can't... There's never enough. It's like never enough. That's what Michael was talking about earlier. So for me, it's like whatever you do in your life, whether it's about money or it's about your career or it's about love, it's like you just have to see that wherever you're at is perfect, always. And then it'll change.
It's so counter to the teaching, the cultural teaching, which is you are either this or that. You are a loser or a go-getter based on based initially on your circumstance, but with the caveat that if you work really, really hard, it's okay to be in a bad circumstance because one day you'll look back on it and ha-ha.
Yeah.
And what Chris is describing is what I used to always see in the really happy, successful people that I knew. They didn't do it. They didn't really set the goal and make the plan. They may have had targets. They may have done some of that. But that was never driving the bus. That they just did. They really enjoyed their lives and what they did. And stuff happened and things evolved and things grew. And if you know that, if you know that I get to have my... here's how I'd say it. I get to eat my cake and have it too. I get to live in this feeling. And then I actually will also wind up with some neat stuff that it may or may not have ever occurred to me I would have come. It may have been on my pipe dream list. Mm-hmm. It may not have been on my pipe dream list. But damn, like That's the beauty of it. It's even better than that. Like the number of times in life I want to say, don't order yet, because it's even better. You know, not only do you not have to wait to have the love and the good feeling and the connection and the well-being, but everything else will be added unto you. You know, I know any time the Bible starts to make sense, I'm onto something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like suddenly you go, oh, yeah, I get that.
You know, when I first started to learn the principles, I had, you know, again, never taken a vacation longer than 5 days off of work. So I went down for my first three-week training and then signed up for a year-long program where I'd go back and forth to Florida from Minnesota for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And so by the end of July, when I went down for my, it was my sixth week for that year that I had gone down there, airfare, hotel room, time away, because when you're in private practice, if you're not working, you're not making any money. And I was fine. And then one day I got insecure and I started thinking like, hey, I haven't taken this much time off of work ever. How am I still paying the bills? Hey, how much money have I spent on travel? Hey, oh my gosh, $20,000. When have I ever had an extra $20,000? And you know, by the end of that month, I had to borrow $1,000 from my mother. It's like as soon as I started thinking about it, it was like somehow I had a problem. And I got it. I was like, oh, I get it. So I stopped thinking about not having enough money. And I paid my mother back, and by October, I was down for another 2 weeks. So I just really learned from that that I just don't care about money. I mean, I don't spend money frivolously. You know, it's a very important thing. And Sid told me once, he said, just remember, Chris, that money is spiritual just like everything else. So you'll always have enough if you live from enough. If you live from lacking, you're always lacking. So whatever you need will come. And that's the thing, not to worry about that. Because it's easy to kind of get caught up in the world, isn't it? Where people are making this much money and you got to have this kind of car and you got to do this kind of thing. And it's just that you've got to find that contentment in yourself. And then you'll know and see what to do. Kind of the, it's kind of like life finds you in an interesting way. Like,
yes, the Jackie microphone, please, and then we'll go to the virtual. We'll go to Elaine after. No, go ahead.
Yes, I saw something during the break about suffering, because I'm pretty hip now that my feelings come from my thinking.
Nice.
And all the feelings are okay. I got that. But I think that a lot. I don't see it all the time. And I managed to upset myself about something during the break. It actually wasn't what we were talking about. But something came up, and I started thinking about it, and I was starting to cry. And I saw it. I saw the mechanism of that so clearly, and I saw that, you know, I'm so afraid of feeling because I can't control them. That when I have a feeling that I don't want, I try not to control it, which is a lot more thinking about the feeling, and it perpetuates it. And that's the suffering.
Yeah.
The suffering is getting stuck in those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So that feeling passed, and I'm kind of like, I do have like 10 million feelings every minute when I let them go.
Yeah.
I do.
Cool. Thanks. Thank you.
I call that a visitation. It's like this, suddenly this thing happens in your head and you're like gripped by it again. And it's real. And then you remember, oh yeah, this isn't real, it's just a thought.
Rami, you won't have it. I have always wondered what Michael meant when on another weekend he was talking about the snow globe metaphor and noted that there are snow globes within snow globes. Fancy stuff. Based on today's discussion, did he mean that the understandings about the three principles just keep happening? Or like Christine said, to remember that we really don't know what the three principles is, that every time we describe it, it is only what we understand in that moment. Perhaps you could say a bit more about the snow globes within the snow globes.
Okay, so I want to make a couple of around that conversation comments, and I will actually address which. I actually think I know what she means, so I'm going to try. But the first is that metaphors are a double-edged sword. They're a very useful way of helping us see the invisible and grasp the ungraspable and F the ineffable. But then if we start to try and follow it through, it falls apart because it's just a metaphor. So we compare something to the way the body, we compare mental health to physical health, and say that the body is always moving towards health and the mind is always moving towards health. And then somebody says, yeah, but when the body does this, it blah, 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 blah. Well, that's where the metaphor breaks down. So there are times where I really mean what I say in the metaphor, but it doesn't hold if you try and then use it here and here and here and here and here because it's localized. So I just want to acknowledge that it's, you know, if you hear something that sounds conflicting, it's because it probably is.
Can I tell a funny story about this? We were listening to Sid Banks one time, and he was talking about the geese and how the geese would migrate from Canada down to Mexico or wherever. And he said, and the little hummingbirds latch onto one of the geese, and the geese takes them down, and is the force that allows them to fly that far, and it's helping them. And in the context of the conversation we were having, it was like latching on to somebody at a higher level of consciousness to get you to a new place, you know? And so Joe goes home and he tells the story to some men in a men's group. And he was still having a really good feeling from it, but the men took it and they started to look it up when they went home. So the next week they came to group and they go, that's not true. Hummingbirds don't do that. And so what you're saying is that the story is really about the story and the moment and the feeling, and it's not about accuracy, like right or wrong. It's like you want to listen for the feel of it, what the person is pointing to, because that's what we're doing. We're kind of like pointing to this thing that nobody can see that's inside of all of us. And so we're doing the best job we can to get you to see what's inside of you.
And because the question's fair enough, and I actually, as I say, I think I know what you're referring to. So in Coaching from the Inside Out, the home study program, there's a section, one of the lessons, I don't remember which one, where I talk about snow globes all the way down. And I think there's a clip from it on YouTube that anybody can see that's free. And I talk about how it's the difference between your mood, your state of mind in the moment, and levels of consciousness at a deeper level. So whatever level of consciousness I'm at, I'm going to have ups and downs. So my snow globe might be shaken up in terms of my personal thinking might be agitated. But that can happen in a really peaceful place inside me. And so the confusion in trying to talk about it is it sounds like there's only one kind of feeling. So I'm in a good mood or a bad mood. And this is saying, I thought for a long time when people talked about the feeling and the principles, they were saying I should try and be happy all the time, like try and be in a good mood all the time. And that's what I had been trying to do for 25 years. And I knew that that was kind of a futile endeavor. And what I started to see was that there is this place inside us, this level of being where you can be in a terrible mood and having a wonderful day. You can be in touch with this feeling of life even as you're wanting to punch someone. And like the most recent time was I was in the airport in London, supposed to catch a late flight to Denmark where I was teaching the next day. And the flight was delayed and then got delayed and then got delayed. And then I found out I didn't actually have to even be in Denmark till 5 o'clock the next afternoon. So I shouldn't have even been trying to fly out that night. And I just went off and I started writing emails, why is this going on? And why is this going on? And I knew, even as I was in it, I knew I was full of shit. Like I really did. I didn't, there was no sense in which I was genuinely angry. And I genuinely knew that I wouldn't be at some point. And so I only sent one of the emails. And I sent it to the person who I knew would ignore it. And they did. But that's what I meant in the snow globe metaphor. Another way I've talked about it before is with a voltmeter, which goes from 0 to 100. Well, you can set what 0 is and what 100 is. So 0, is one end of a scale, and that could be literally 0 volts to 100 volts, or 0 to 100 could be going between 0 and 1 volt. It'll be the same 0 to 100 scale, but it's measuring a completely different level of voltage. Well, as we expand in consciousness, as we go deeper, as we start to see this at a deeper level, as we go deeper into the feeling, we're still going to have the same range of fluctuation within it, but it's within a much, much, much bigger range of possible well-being. And these are more metaphors that if you take them too seriously and try and work out exactly, they won't probably hold. And yet, I don't know of another way of trying to describe that weird feeling of there is chaos under the heavens and the situation is excellent. So that's what I meant. What else?
It's kind of along this, we actually spoke in, it seems like it's kind of along the same lines with, I'm wanting to get back to this way I used to be eating. I kind of get that it would be better if I accepted the fact that I wasn't doing it, but there's a little bit of an impatience there that thinks if I accept it, then when's it going to happen? You know, like, I'm just not all the way down with it yet. I'm not all the way just, like, it's just not there yet. I just want to do it. I know I've done it before without even thinking about it, right? But that's not happening for me right now.
I did a radio show years ago, and I stole the title of a Philip Yancey book called What's So Amazing About Grace? And I shared the idea of the unconditional love. That the implication of unconditional love, and in this case, God's unconditional love, this unconditional love inside us, is that there's nothing you can do to make God love you any less. And there's nothing you can do to make God love you any more. And that was radical for me. This idea that actually this feeling was unearned. It was grace. It wasn't the fruits of my labors and efforts. And so I did a show about that. And a woman phoned in the next week and said, well, I've been really struggling with my husband, and I listened to the show last week and I really liked it, and I tried that unconditional love thing and it didn't work. What else you got? And the thing is, this isn't a formula for doing anything. This is not a formula for getting yourself to do anything. This is not a formula for getting yourself anywhere. This is, as best I get it, a truth about us and who we are and about life and what life is. And it's just that as we see whatever we see about it and rest in the feeling of it, we're smarter about stuff. We have more common sense about things. We're less hard on ourselves. We suffer less. We get more insights and great ideas. But it doesn't work in the way that a technique would work.
I'm just looking at your face. I don't know what that means.
I got something.
Yeah, I know. That's what I saw. I saw that you got something. Okay. Cool. All right. I can see it.
So what do you make of the fact that you don't do that?
Well, the thing is, I have a pretty intense health issue. And that was working. Or maybe it was, I don't really know that for sure, to be honest with you, but things were looking good in terms of my health. And then I wasn't even thinking about doing that, I just was. I was a little self-righteous about it in my head, like I didn't tell people, but I for 2 years just thought, well, people are saying they're this or that, why don't they just eat like I do? Then I went into a place where I just started eating a lot, and I kind of got reacquainted with eating that kind of food, and now I'm having a tough time going back. So, like, I think that I still believe that that would be helpful in my situation. So, like, kind of, what the fuck am I doing? If I think that's helpful, why aren't I doing that?
Yeah. Yeah, so why don't you just do it? You're doing way too much thinking about it, that's the deal. See, and I think you just have to, like, you know, it's like there's a way that we know exactly what we need to do in it with our body. We just have to quiet down about it and just wait to see what comes to you about that. I don't know what you should do, and I don't know how you should do it, but you do. You just have to know that you know.
And what shifted in that description that you just gave us is you started out describing wisdom, and you wound up describing a strategy. Like, you just did it for a while. You just did it. It's just what you did. And then it started becoming a thing and an identity and, you know, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And now it's a strategy that you think you should be applying, but it wasn't when you started. It came from a different place in you. You didn't have a big debate with yourself from what you just described about, now, how do I get myself to eat this way? And do, right? That's wisdom just comes to us. And I was talking to somebody in the break about the confusing thing is, it's very easy to think you know where wisdom's taking you and go, okay, I got it from here. Oh, I see, we're doing this. That's right, you and I were talking about it. It's like, oh, I see, okay, I'm now gonna do this, or I'm now gonna become this, or this is now what I am or what I'm up to. But actually, then you've disconnected from wisdom and kind of made it a thing that you do. And the part of the art of living, for lack of a better way of saying it right now, is getting a feel for the difference between when you're following that flow or that unfolding of wisdom and when it started to become an intellectual exercise and a strategic plan. And none of that tells you what to do about this. But it's true for all of us, right? Every single person I know has moments of absolutely just following the flow of wisdom, usually to the point where you wouldn't say you're doing that because you're just not even conscious of it. You're just doing it. And then places where you think you know what you're supposed to be doing and you beat yourself up about not doing it. Well, wisdom never feels like that, ever. It's just not how it's, you know, I remember reading some spiritual metaphor about a soldier, and they were to confuse the enemy. The enemy set up a tent that looked just like the commander's tent, and sent orders the same way that the commander of their army did. So this guy would get these two sets of conflicting orders, and wouldn't know what to do until he figured out, I just need to know where these orders are coming from, and then I'll know what to do. And you start to find your way of connecting to the feeling of wisdom, to the feeling of that inner guidance, that spiritual intelligence in you. And it feels so different to the intellectual guidance. It feels so different to the plan. It feels so different to the good ideas. And I remember having a conversation with somebody, it might have been you and I, Sarah, not that long ago. No, it was Barb. I was talking to Barb about something. We were talking about how subtle that was, that difference. And then it occurred to me, you know what? I bet this isn't subtle at all. I think I just have no refinement to my taste yet. I think these two things are probably as different can be. And I'm just too noisy to notice right now. And that's been my experience. As I've settled down, it's become more and more obvious what's different. And then when I noise back up, it's subtle again.
You know, you just got to keep things simple. Because when we're so used to like creating problems for ourselves, we just like create a problem and then we try to solve it. And so it's all just not important. What's important is just getting into a really beautiful state of mind, and then you'll know what to do with your body. And it'll come more naturally without you having to like make it an issue, you know? Like when I moved to Hawaii and I always worked out in a gym, and there's no gym to work out in. And so I thought, well, I live in Hawaii, I'll just go walking and that'll be fine. But it rains a lot, and then by the time I'd get to exercise, it was dark, there's no street lights. So it didn't seem like a very, you know, good thing to do, to go walking in the middle of the night. And so I was like grumbling about it and how I need to get exercising, I need to do something. And I'd walk around my house on the talking on the phone, walk around my house and try to be creative about it. And then I went to the doctor and I picked up some weight, and suddenly I was testing high on my blood pressure. And I've always had low blood pressure, so the first time I went in, I said, ah, that's not right. I must have been in a rush getting here. And then I was going because I had some issues with my hand, so I had to go to like two or three doctors, you know, in a month. And the second doctor said, oh, your blood pressure's elevated. It's like, ugh, no, my blood pressure's not elevated. And then the third time it happened, I said, no, oh, you know, this is the third time I've said this. Like I was listening now, right? I said, oh, this is the third time I said this. Maybe you better check it. So he checks it. He goes, yeah, I think we should put you on high blood pressure medicine. I was like mortified. Oh, my God. I was upset about that, and I thought, what am I going to do? I'm over here in Hawaii. I can't get to a gym, and I can't exercise, and that's why I put on weight, and now my blood pressure's up, and blah, 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 blah. And then I took myself by the hand. I said, get a grip. Go buy an exercise machine. So I did that. And then, like, I don't have time to exercise. I have to drive so far to blah, 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 blah. I'm a whiner, you know. And so luckily I don't like do it out loud much anymore, but I was doing it in my head quite a bit. And then I thought, look, there's enough time for everything in your life, and you know that. So make the time and do it. So I do it. And suddenly I had a half an hour every day to do it, and within 2 months I was off the high blood pressure medicine, and my weight was back down, and I was fine. But I had to make a decision to change. You know, it's like I just had to do it differently. And I had to realize that all the thinking I had about why I couldn't do it wasn't real. I was just making it up. I was suffering at the hand of my inability to control myself, get things to do done. Drama is another one of my favorite things.
Yeah. I think it's almost like that part before the butt. Like you go, well, I could buy an exercise machine. Okay, so you buy it. I could exercise, but now I don't have time. Now this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's, because I do this all the time too, it feels like then I want to make sure I choose the right choice. Like there's all these buts, and I'm coming up with all these buts, and think, and now I have all these options. I want to make sure I'm choosing the right one. Mm. So it's, I kind of overthink any situation where it's really just, I've got the machine that's exercise. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's what you're describing, that all that. That's what trying to navigate your life from your intellect feels like. Mm-hmm. It feels like a constant negotiation mm-hmm. and discussion and conversation mm-hmm. and comparison and evaluation. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of the mm-hmm. intellect. That's what it's good for. And that's really useful except for trying to navigate your life where mm-hmm. it's totally not useful. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's a simplicity to wisdom. You just are either doing it or you know, there's just nothing else. There's no noise around it. I remember one year, I think I've shared this story before, but I used to do the best year yet every year, this program where you'd go through and you'd work out your top 10 goals for the year, and you're this and you're that. And one year, I got to the end of the first month, end of January, and Davey and I were doing our weekly midnight hike in the hills. And I suddenly realized I was living two lives. I was working my plan, and then there was this whole thing that was happening organically around work and different ideas that I was loving, that was flowing out of this real joy in me. And it was the first time I'd seen it that clearly, because I was doing both. I was being disciplined and working my intellect's plan. But I was also unfolding this wisdom and joy. And that was the beginning of my kind of going, oh, I get to choose. I get to choose which one I want to listen to here. Mm-hmm. And of course, like anything else, the more you listen to something, the easier it is to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just have learned how to override our wisdom. So, you know, your wisdom comes in really quiet, and then you go, oh, I'll do it later. And then it comes in again, and like, oh, I haven't got time now. And depending on your state of mind, it might come in and go, I haven't got time to do that anymore. It's like you're just at the effect of your own thinking. So the first thing you take care of is yourself and your state of mind, and then the rest you'll see what to do. It's always, you got to start here and then do your life and not try to do your life so that you get in a better place here. Just a really subtle way we get outside in. We're so frequently trying to figure out what to do in our life so that we feel better here. Just always turn it around. Like, okay, what do I need to change to do it to be in a good feeling right now without changing my life?
And it's funny because if you've done any other self-help stuff, which almost everyone has, that's the opposite of what everyone else is telling you to do. Mm-hmm. And so you the normal places, I remember this for me. I, you know, it's really interesting because we're about to move in a month. And I'm so looking forward to putting away another two-thirds of my books. Like when we moved to this house, got rid of about half of them. And now moving to a place where I'm looking forward to just not having them there anymore. I used to like to just have them in case. It's like my little return pads just in case I need them. And I've just started to see, no, they're pointing me in a different direction. They're pointing me to more effectively live from the outside in. To be better at manipulating my experience by manipulating my circumstances. And that's just not a direction I'm interested in getting better at anymore. Mm-hmm. That's a skill I don't want to improve. That's something that I'm no longer interested in mastering. Mm-hmm. It's like, it was a bad idea before. Being better at it isn't going to help. Mm-hmm. It's like Stafford Beer had this wonderful quote about systems thinking. where he said, if you take a basically lousy system, but you make it more efficient, you wind up with a more efficiently lousy system. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of the outside in. It's like if you take a basically lousy system for manipulating your experience and you get better at it, then that's what you're better at. And that you know, that's a hell of a thing for me. That has been a hell of a thing for me, because so much of my identity, so much of my career was built for so many years on being really good at that. And to find out that it's actually a useless skill in terms of the life I want to live, which is a life that I'm in love with, was kind of a bummer.
Is that kind of the reason, and maybe it's not like this for everyone, but I think for a lot of people there's this kind of falling apart, when before you move into a better place or a better feeling, there's this falling apart, at least of everything around you. Is that because you're not going with your intellect, because you realize it's not the tool that's gonna make the difference, so you kind of let everything it's created fall by the wayside and begin this falling apart? Because that's for me, I was telling you about like hijacking the process, the concept I come back to, and I think that might be why, because the more I like kick back and let things unfold, the shittier things start to look, at least on paper. And then I look at everything on paper, I'm like, it's not working.
We've got a colleague who was incredibly fit and just like a health nut. And when he started to see the principles and really got it, got the feeling of it, got the taste for it, he put on like 50 pounds. Because the reason he was fit was because he was trying to control his experience through his body. And initially, when he no longer needed to do that, it all did. It just fell away. Now, he then got sensible. He stopped making frivolous choices around his body and, you know, and kind of stabilized at a different level. But there is an element. For me, it was a little different. For me, it was that I desperately wanted to meld the two. I wanted to live from the inside outside in.
You wanted to have it all.
You know, because I had all this outside in stuff. It was a shame to waste it. You know, and it turns out, no. I mean, I tried really hard. You know, that was me.
You know, I just want to say one thing. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, you want to embrace change, but don't think about it too much. You know, it's kind of like, because we try to figure out in your head how you want to be and then do it. That's like how adult learning theory is that we tend to figure it out in our head and then apply it in our life. But this is a whole different kind of learning. So as soon as you're trying to figure out what to do or how to do it, when to do it, just tell yourself it's not important. Because the change will happen from you, as opposed to you changing it. But you just have to be open to change. Because when your wisdom comes in and tells you it's time to change, then you want to see what to change. And most of us kind of override that by why we can't change. You know, can't do the... In fact, I don't know how they do the studies, but they did a study of women, married women having sex. And they said that frequently women would say, no, I'm too tired, I don't want to have sex, I've been with the kids all day. And evidently, within 10 minutes of getting into having sex, they were enjoying it and having a good time. And so it's kind of like our thinking just stops us. It stops you from exercising. So many people say, you know, like, I really want to go to the gym, and when I go to the gym, I feel so much better, but I just don't have time, and I've got all this thinking about not going to the gym. So what happens is we have these good intentions, and we have even our good wisdom showing us where to go, and we override it with our own intellect. So kind of you just got to, like, not be on your case so much. Because the less we think about ourselves, the better off we are. The more we're thinking about ourselves, the more likely we are to get into that insecurity. Because it's just so right there to get into. I'm going to give you an example about overriding your wisdom before we break. I was living in Minnesota, okay, and we bought a fixer-upper house. And my husband had a friend that came up from Hawaii to help him fix the light over the kitchen sink because it wasn't working. So they work on it one day, all Sunday. They're working on it. And I'm kind of like wondering, they know what they're doing. And I'm watching them. And our friend had lived in Minnesota, and he was had been a fireman. And so I thought, well, he knows what to do to be safe. So they did it. And I walked by after they were done, and in my head came, change the light bulb. And I thought, oh, I can't change the light bulb when he's here because, you know, he doesn't like it when I redo what he just did. And so I'll wait because he was leaving for San Diego the next day. And so I got up the next day, and I walked by the light again, and in my head came, change the light bulb. And then my cleaning lady came, and I said, look, I've got light. And I turned on the light, and we're talking. And then it was time for me to go to work, so I just left. And about 4:30 that afternoon, I get a call from my husband's friend. And my husband was a big wave surfer, and they had a little article about him in a surfing magazine. So he took the magazine home and just happened to come back to our house to drop it off. And him being a fireman smelled smoke. And so he walked around. I would have smelled smoke and walked out, got in my car and left. But he smelled smoke. He's walking around the house wondering what's going on, who's burning. And he gets to the front of the house, and all of a sudden the flames come out of the roof. And so he's calling me, trying to get, I'm in session, and finally I thought, oh, I got 3 calls from a long-distance number, I better check it. And he goes, Sister Christine, I'm at your house, and it's on fire. I was like, I'm low! And call me back. So I'm like trying to do it, and I can't do it. And I was like, calm down. Call it back. Brother Joe. He said, your house is on fire. There's 14 fire trucks here. We got one dog out, one dog still in the basement. Okay. And then the police woman comes on, and she goes, now, don't rush home. Like, I'm in this side of the city, and my house is on this side of the city, and it's rush hour, 5 o'clock, right? I'm not going past anywhere. I said, okay. So I call my sister, go and get my dog that's in the basement. So she goes out there, and I'm driving out there. And I get there, and the trucks are all gone by that time, but the fire marshal waited for me to come home. And so he said to me, he said, well, would you like to know the cause of the fire? And I said, yeah. He said, it was a 100-watt light bulb in a 60-watt socket. And I started laughing, and he's looking at me like I'm crazy. And I said, well, I had that thought to change that light bulb twice, but did I listen to it? No. I just overrode it with my own, I'll do it later, and I suffered the consequences. So the other thing is, about a week before that, I was telling my sister how much I wanted to remodel my kitchen. So both of us walk. He said, would you like to see it? So we walk in. I just had these new Brazilian teak floors put down. And here's all the insulation. You know, Minnesota, they have insulation in their houses, like big time. So all this burned insulation on top of these floors. And my sister and I both burst out laughing. We both thought the same thing. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to get my kitchen remodeled. And she said, I was just thinking about that too. But it's such a great example of how we kind of know what's to do in our life, and then we override it. And so now the fire marshal really thinks we're on drugs or something. And I said, I'm sorry, but you know, I knew to change that light bulb, and I didn't listen to myself. And what I do all day long is teach people to listen to their wisdom. So it was a lesson in humility. But it just goes to show you that if you're not really awake, you're not listening. You know, you're not listening to your wisdom, and you're not paying attention to how your little pea brain is overriding your good sense until afterwards. That's when people notice it, right? It's like, oh, I knew I shouldn't have said that. I knew I should have called you. Like, hindsight is always 20/20 because we look back, and at the time we really knew not to do it or to do it, but we didn't know to listen. I didn't know to listen. Of course, that didn't excuse me this time because I definitely knew to listen, but wasn't listening.
Go to Liz and then Wendy.
I think you said before that life isn't a breadfruit, that you actually realize the little synchronicities that happen in your life when you look back at how far you've come and what has happened in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that has helped me a lot because I used to be a control freak, and that whole trust issue, trust your wisdom, was really not working for me at all. And then when I started kind of looking back to where I was, like, I was born in Hungary, and I moved to Germany, Canada, back to Germany, and Albuquerque, now I'm here. Like, all these things that happened in my life, and I'm sitting right here, and I'm listening to what I'm really supposed to hear. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at it, it's like, wow, it's all made sense.
Yeah.
I got here.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see that before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you get to be my age, then you're really going to see it, because it's like, oh, man.
I feel like it's brewing. And I just have this one thing, is that I've been doing this very well with a lot of other things. But maybe this is my thinking, and it's with the three principles words, it's like I'm waiting for an insight, and I'm thinking that maybe that's bullshit. Maybe that's just my mind saying I'm waiting for an insight, because I'm just like when you said, just why don't you just do it? So it's brewing. I don't know.
Yeah. Let it brew. Let it brew. Yeah.
It's amazing how we can make trouble for ourselves when it's simple.
So, I know I'm wrong asking this question, but I want to ask it anyway. So, I could see getting quieter and just stepping back and go back to that quiet feeling when I'm at home or when I'm not very engaged. You know, I tend to feel good when meditating. But I feel at work, it's this kind of like this 10-hour period that I'll get to do it before or after, but those 10 hours, that's as a rule, I can't, and I'm beginning to see maybe that's not true either, but maybe if you just could speak to it.
Well, I'll do a quick take, because to me, that speaks to the essential difference between finding the state of meditation and meditating. That you know, meditating, it does. If it works for you, you get the 20 minutes plus maybe another up to 2 hours, depending, like hit. I mean, I remember when I used to meditate regularly, I knew I'd be good for at least 10 minutes after, and then maybe it could stretch. And then I just tried to meditate more, right? So I thought, well, okay, maybe if I meditate twice a day, and you know, or three times a day, I got up to at one point. But if this is the floor, if meditation, the state of meditation, this feeling that we're talking about, is home base, is always available, then what you're beginning to see is the absolute truth. It doesn't matter whether you're at work or not. You don't have to wait till you get home. It's here now. And what starts to happen is work just feels different. And what starts to happen, depending on what you do, is at some point, work may look stupid to you, and you may not do it anymore. You may go do something different. Or you suddenly realize, this is great. I don't need to do anything different. This pays the bills. No problem. Because I can fall in love with life, not just the bits that I like. Because the love isn't out there in the bits. That state of meditation isn't only available when I'm at home not working, or when I'm sitting in the lotus position, or when I'm doing my practice. It's a principle. It's fundamental. It's always available. And so what starts to happen, as I experience it, is life just gets infused with this flavor. And it's such a beautiful thing. It's like a seasoning that brings out the flavor in everything else. It doesn't have quite a flavor of its own, but it makes everything else taste better. And that's what this inner place of well-beingness. Mm-hmm. You know, this mind, this pure consciousness, this whatever it is that all traditions point to. I mean, every single spiritual tradition points to it. And they have different names for it and different ideas about what you have to do to get it. But it's a common thread. It's part of the perennial philosophy. And it's just that it's closer than you think. How cool is that?
I want to just say one thing more about that, is that that's kind of the reason that when we teach this, we don't teach techniques. Because people will make that state of mind be about what they did. Like, okay, I meditated and that's why I'm quiet. And really, the quieting of your mind happens with insight. Like, you can like kind of manage it a little bit after the fact, but as you get more insight, your mind just gets quieter. And there's no accounting for that. It's just that you're not as insecure, you're not in that state of mind as much. So, like, sometimes I can feel I'm going really fast, and I'll say to myself, okay, I gotta quiet down. But then I don't go do anything. I just, see, for me, it's overwhelmed. Like, when I'm busy in my mind, I have way too many projects. I always have way too many projects going, but I just get overwhelmed about it sometimes. And that's my signal that I have too much going on in my mind. So it's not about managing your thinking. It's about getting a shift in the state of consciousness that you're doing life from. And then you're already there. So that's why you keep going deeper, because each time you get deeper, you realize there's deeper, there's more. And then you move into that state, and then it just kind of comes with the insight. As opposed to doing something, because when you're doing something to manage your thinking, like, and there's a zillion techniques. I mean, people make exercise a technique. People make meditation a technique. They make drinking alcohol a technique. It's all things that we're doing trying to get to what is already in us. It's like it's already there, so we don't have to do anything to get it. We just have to let go and relax, and it's right there. But when you don't know that's where it is, think you have to do something to help it along. I always think of it as kind of like, you know, it's your the game of life is like the train that goes through the mountains, you know, the scenic route up to Lake Tahoe. And you on that train, and it's just a spectacular view. But you can either be in the club car with white linen tablecloths, drinking tea and looking at the scenery, or you can get between the two cars and push with your foot, thinking you're helping. You just have to relax and enjoy the ride.
This one is from Jazzy J. It's about the light bulb story. Wow, what Christine just said generates lots of fear in me. We know what to do in our lives, and we override it.
You did it. You scared Jazz.
I knew that was there in me, but what if we can't do everything our wisdom is telling us, and that's why we override it?
Too much thinking about it. You know, it's there. Your wisdom will, you'll always know what to do. If it's your wisdom, you'll know. So if you don't know, that's not it. My rule of thumb is whatever the question is that's posed in my mind, the answer, I put it into a formula, is if you don't know, don't. So if I don't know if I should call somebody, then I don't. If I don't know if I should stop from calling them, then I call them. Did I say that right? So if I don't know if I should, if I didn't know if I should come and do this thing with Michael, if I don't know, don't. So if I didn't know, I would say no. If I did know, then I go along with that. So, 'cause when my wisdom is at work, I don't have to think about it. I don't question whether it's right or wrong. I don't question if it's a good idea or not. I just know that that's what I want to do. So it's kind of that knowing. Like in Sid Banks, if you read like Second Chance or especially Second Chance, he really talks about that deeper knowing. And when we're connected with our wisdom, we know. When we get afraid, that's just our intellect trying to make trouble again.
Time I hear it, it resonates differently. When you talked about looking back on things we've done, knowing now what we know, and trying to take what we knew, know now and look at and judge what we did then.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something about like, you only know what you know when you know it in the moment. And I just find that to be such a profound thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when she asked that,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it, you know, it's like we jump at any opportunity to judge ourselves and to, you know, scare ourselves. So I would, you know, it's kind of like when you're afraid, don't be afraid of your wisdom, because your wisdom is always going to be right there and you'll be able to follow it. You just have to not overthink it.
I mean, we can always prove our theory. And if our theory is I suck, we can always prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a great old joke about a psychiatrist who believed that all our problems are caused by fish in the dreams. If you have fish in your dreams, it's a portent of bad things. So he'd sit with a client. The client would tell them about what was going on in their life. And he'd say, did you sleep last night? Yeah. Did you dream? Yeah, I think I probably did. And was there any water in your dream? Well, yeah, I mean, there might have been some puddles in the street. And were there fish in the puddles? Right? Like, we can find the bit that we fucked up if our basic premise is we're fuck-ups. Right? We can find the bit where life screwed us if our basic premise is life screws us. And that's the problem, is it seems like we're getting good data, but we're not. We're just selecting the data that fits our pre-existing theory. Mm-hmm. And that's what people do, yeah.
So two things. One, how do you get rid of that pre-existing theory about yourself? You feel like I suck, you know, that, fuck up. And two, if your wisdom is saying something, like she said, that you don't feel you can do, like whether or not you can, if you don't think you can, even if it's your wisdom coming and you don't think you can do it.
I've got the first one.
Do it.
I've got the first one. I don't know about the second one, but let me stick with the first one. Why would you do anything about it? It's like, I know I think that, but it now makes me laugh that I think that. It's like, oh, it's, yeah, okay, I suck. Got it. You know, it's not news. It's not, it really, literally, it hasn't changed. I still am surprised when anything I do works, right? Like I used to joke that my, if I ever wrote an autobiography, it would be called, Who Knew It Would Actually Work? Because I go into things so sure that it's not gonna work, that I'm continually surprised. But it doesn't seem to me like anything other than that thought again. It doesn't have the weightiness that it used to have when it felt like a real thing that I had to really take into account and I had to really do something about. So I know that's just, okay, well, that's me, that's my experience. But it's not, the thing about thought is that it's, okay, I'm gonna try this. Like a cloud shaped like a scary lion is not more dangerous than a cloud shaped like a Labrador puppy. It looks like a scary lion and the other one looks like a cute puppy, but they're both clouds. So the thought that I suck is not more significant than the thought that I'm awesome. And the thought that I'm awesome is not more significant than the thought that I suck. But over time, if I think that the lion cloud is a real lion, of course I'm going to do everything I can to protect myself from it. That just makes sense. That would be common sense. If that were a real lion, I should freaking do whatever I know to do to protect myself from it. So the reason I think that as we get insight into the nature of thought, it's so much more powerful than just changing our thinking, is because you start to see it's all clouds. And the particular shape or form that the cloud takes doesn't make it a better cloud or a worse cloud or a cloud that I need to do something about, as opposed to all those clouds I can just let be in the sky. Mm. So that's how it's different for me than it used to be. Not that I've changed those thoughts. But because I don't give them much thought, I don't notice them as often. I might have them as often as I used to, I don't know. But when I notice them, it's more like, as opposed to, you know, which is what it used to be like. Does that have any?
It does.
Yeah, okay.
It does. I mean, I can see what you're saying. It's just that I have so much evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's fish in every single one of your dreams. I got it.
I had like,
yeah,
25 year relationships, successful career, and all that stuff. And that could maybe be like, well, that's not really true or whatever. I could ignore it.
See, this is the deal, is that you're giving your thoughts a lot of credibility, and what you see in your thought in your life is your thoughts. That's what you're seeing.
So the thought creates reality thing? Your mm-hmm. thoughts create your reality?
What you see in reality, that's why you're validating it with, look at my past, da 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 da. But you're the one that thinks there's something wrong with you. No one else does. Well, you might have convinced some other people of that.
I mean, you can sell.
See, as when we really believe it, we do a lot of stupid things because we're looking at life from a position of that there's something wrong. But you have to just see it's just a state of mind, because there are times when you're not there, right? Yes, okay. So you just have the way I think about it is that in the part of the program in your mind that has what is your first name again?
Marie-Francois
is blah blah blah. You've got a virus in that program. And so every time you activate it, it starts to infect the other programs. And now it's kind of spread through the whole computer, okay? But it's not real. It's just thought. Okay, and you've been thinking it over and over and over again, and the more you think about something, this is how consciousness works. Now, be listening, be careful. You have a thought, and consciousness makes it seem real to you. So consciousness is the reality maker. And so it doesn't matter, like, you remember the story about me being tall? Now, that seems silly to you, right? But honestly, in my world, that was as true as could be, and it had... Like, in my mind, I had a lot of validation as to why that was. My mother said I was tall. People thought I had a tall personality. I would wear boots and tall shoes, so I was tall. You know, all kinds of stuff, because that seemed real to me. But it's only when you're in a bad state of mind that you go into that kind of thinking. That's the only time it's real. But you're in some way, you've learned to give that thinking more credibility. This is the truth about me. And yeah, when I feel good, that's just, that's a nice thing, but it's not really me. And the deal is that's you, and this is just what you're creating. I promise you, that's all it is. See, your intellect is working overtime to maintain control over you. No, 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 see, you're different, I'm special. And I know that what happens is when we think that about ourselves, we manage to find things and experiences and people that validate the crap out of that. It's like, you know, if you get a new car, or another car, if it's not a new car, but you get a car, and you start thinking, oh, there's not many cars like this in the world. And you just drive it off the lot, and suddenly they're everywhere. You know, or people frequently, if they get pregnant, they suddenly see Pampers commercials, and they see baby formula and all the stuff that they never even saw before. So literally, if you're looking for trouble, you'll see it.
I want to tell a quick story, and then I want to break for lunch just because of where we are in the day. And so live streamers will give us 5 minutes after we break, and then we'll meet you on Zoom. I think somebody sent the link through to them.
Annette?
Do they have the link?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great.
They won't hear that message because he's having a reception.
Oh, okay, so that was...
Oh, great.
Video, people watching the video back, this is of no use to you whatsoever. Okay, so... okay, so live streamers.
Too bad you missed it. It was really good.
You'll figure out why we're laughing when you watch the video back. But I'm going to tell a story. We're going to break for lunch, and then give us 5 minutes after we break, and then Christine and I are going to meet you on Zoom, and you've got the link. So when I was... I can't remember if I was 19 or 20, but I was going to go to England to be an actor. And in a way, in my mind, I was going to England to escape my past, because I'm depressed and suicidal and mandatory therapy and all of this stuff. And I kind of thought, fresh start, fresh country, fresh new thing. And I had been assigned a social worker who was there to monitor me and make sure I was not a danger to myself or others. And he said, a nice guy. I mean, you know, I was struggling. I mean, I cried for 3 days because I had ordered a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt and it was the wrong one. Because I had had a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt that made me feel safe and loved. And I lost it. And when I ordered the replacement and it was the wrong one, that was it. That my source of love and well-being was gone. And my parents spotted that something was not quite right with me. Now, they were pretty blind to most of it. But like that one, they began, because I was home that summer, and they began to see, wow, something's not quite as we think it should be. Very intelligent and intellectual people, though. So it was like, yeah. Well, so my mom came down to the basement I was living in. She, I could tell, even in my state of mind, I could tell she really wanted to help. And she said, do you know, when I was little, and she grew up in the war, I mean, she had like, you know, lots of people died around her. So, you know, I got her experience was a little more really sucky than mine was. But she said, I really found it helpful to think about things that I liked. That's all she said. It was kind of like, you know, these are a few of my favorite things. And I'd never had a chat like this with my mom. I mean, you know, that was not the basis of our relationship. But I remember feeling comforted. And then she said, you know, I think you're going to be okay. I think you are okay. I think you just think too much. This is my mom. This was the scientist. This was the Marie Curie of Belgium, right? And I felt so comforted. I felt hopeful for the first time in a long, long time. And I had a session with my social worker the next day. And I told him about this. And I said, you know, I really kind of heard what she said. And I really thought, you know, I am okay. And I just think too much. And he said, it'd be nice to believe that, wouldn't it? Now, I know he meant well. But I didn't have enough grip on my shoes on that feeling for it to carry me through that. You've got that social worker living in your head. That's what it looks like to me. That's why I told the story, because I recognized that, yeah, but it'd be nice, but, and I don't know that there's anything you can do about the social worker in your head, but you can get more grip on your shoes. You can get more of this feeling in those moments between times. And that will carry you. And I can't say anything other than that is genuinely 100% what it looks like to me. And you know where we are. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back. Let's go. So it won't quite be an hour and a half. We'll come back at 2:30 to begin at 2:30, and live streamers, we'll see you in 5 minutes on Zoom. Thanks, guys.